Welcome to this episode of Religion and American Life, a podcast of the Blasey Center for Religion and American Public Life here at Boston College. I am Mark Massa, a Jesuit priest. I am also the director of the Blasey Center, and I am today's podcast host. This podcast is the newest initiative in the Blasey Center's commitment to connecting a community of scholars, policymakers, media, and religious leaders in conversation and scholarly reflection around issues at the intersection of religion and American public life. It gives me great pleasure today to be speaking with one of the stars of Boston College's History Department, Father Charlie Gallagher of the Society of Jesus, to discuss his recently published book, Nazis of Copley Square, The Forgotten History of the Christian Front, 1939 to 1945. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Mark. It's really great to be here with Blasey.
Charlie arrived, just in background for our listeners, Charlie arrived at Boston College in 2010 from the Geneva School of Diplomacy. And in 2008, he had published a book entitled Vatican Secret Diplomacy, Joseph Hurley and Pope Pius XII. It had been published by Yale University Press. It was greeted with much praise, and it won the John Gilmary Shea Prize from the American Catholic Historical Association, which is a big deal. It's a very big deal for Catholic historians. Just last year, Charlie published his most recent book entitled Nazis of Copley Square by Harvard University Press. I've been reading reviews of it, and reviews are, to be honest with you, Charlie, suspiciously all positive. I mean, they all say things like, you know, this book provides a crucial missing chapter in the history of the American far right. And how could historians have missed this for so long? So Charlie, kudos to you. You know, I think you're in for a good ride, as we say. So give the listener some idea of what this book is about.
So this book is about a little known group of working class American Catholics who have escaped the view of American Catholic social historians for the last few decades. The origins and the history of the group was clouded in secrecy because, and I think it was neglected because so many American historians immediately rushed towards church archives in order to write American Catholic history. And in fact, the history of this group was placed in national security archives, archives of the FBI, the Office of Strategic Services, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and even the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps archives. And so this was a group that was outside of the institutional church's history because it was a decidedly lay organization. It was led in its public-facing role by lay Catholic leaders. It, however, had very important shadow theologians who were priests who helped to prop it up and keep it vital from the late 1930s through the end of World War II. So it was a group that in its New York manifestation was charged with sedition, that is the violent overthrow of the U.S. government, a case that went to trial in the spring and summer of 1940 that captured headlines coast to coast. And then after that case was adjudicated and the group was in fact acquitted of sedition, which is a fascinating story in itself, the movement moved north and its epicenter became Boston, where its leadership fell into the arms of a Nazi SS intelligence officer who was then serving as the diplomatic consul in Boston. So there's another reason why it was overlooked, I think, was because the membership, which ranged anywhere from 30,000 members to 100,000 members, largely on the East Coast, but there were some West Coast affiliates, those people had no idea that the paramilitary wing, which was secretive, the paramilitary wing was plotting insurrection. The ordinary Catholics in the group had no idea about that. And then the ordinary Catholics in Boston had no idea that their leader was meeting secretly with a Nazi official and taking direction from him.
So this is very interesting. So as I understand from the book, there were, what, 17 people active in Boston in the group, but from your estimate, there's somewhere between 30,000 and 100,000 people who were receiving their information or in some way connected with the group. Right. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, so the way the numbers work is that the unofficial number from Father Coughlin, who was the inspirational leader of the group, was that there were 100,000 active members by 1939. He wanted 5 million members. In the paramilitary wing, there was a paramilitary unit, secretive unit, called the Action Committee. These were men who trained with weapons and made bombs. They were mainly in Brooklyn in 1939. That group numbered about 17 individuals, and they were the ones who were actually put on trial because the FBI was able to get a plant within that group. But the numbers range between 30,000 and 100,000 active members. So we can put there, you know, it's difficult to say because the membership rolls were destroyed before the trial. And even in the Boston case, the leader of the Boston Christian Front refused to hand over the membership rolls to the local police, claiming religious grounds, because he indicated to the police that his group needed the registration to prove that they were not a secret society, right? Because there was a Catholic ban on membership in secret societies. So he had each member of the Christian Front fill out a registration card, of which he kept a copy. And he refused to hand those over on religious grounds, that this was actually a religious principle that was in play. So the membership numbers are pretty raw, but the FBI, by 1940, the FBI put the number of public adherents, public members of the group, at about 30,000, kind of, and mostly concentrated between New York, Philadelphia, and Boston. But these members were attending meetings. They were listening to the propaganda, listening to the message, but they weren't, many of those were not actively participating in any of the paramilitarism or the espionage that would take place in Boston.
Well, so for those who aren't familiar with American Catholic history, Father Charles Coughlin, who was a towering figure in the 1930s and 40s, and a very important media, one of the first big Catholic media figures. I lived in Detroit for a while, so I know a lot about him. He built a church called the Shrine of the Little Flower, which Detroiters refer to as the church that Haight built, because there was a huge tower attached to the church. And he used to broadcast on Sunday afternoons to a national audience. And David O'Brien has this famous story that he said he could walk home. He lived in Brooklyn at the time. He could walk home on a summer day and never miss a single word from Father Coughlin, because every radio was tuned to listen to Charles Coughlin and all the windows were open. So Coughlin was sort of the spiritual founder of this group, would you say, Charlie?
So Coughlin was the spiritual, the inspirational leader of the group. The idea actually originated in England with a Catholic convert called Arnold Lunn. And he ended up becoming a news reporter for the International Catholic Truth Society. And he went over to Spain and was filing reports in Spain as a recently converted Catholic during the Spanish Civil War. And he saw the real persecution that the Popular Front government was meting out towards institutional church members. So seminarians, nuns, and priests being executed by firing squad there. And he decided that all Christian religions in the world needed to come together to face this threat of global communism, which he saw as violent and exterminationist against Roman Catholicism and all Christianity, if it continued to be let loose on the globe. And he came up with the idea of the Christian Front as an idea for what I call ecumenical anti-communism, that all the Christian churches were to join together against communism. And as the communists were taking up arms against Christianity, this Christian Front movement would allow Christians to have a philosophical, legitimate reason to take up arms against their persecutors, the communists.
So I'm curious, Charlie, now where did you or how did you find out about this group, which seems to have been shrouded in secrecy, at least from the terms of professional historians before? How did you get access to this?
Yeah, so the way this worked was when I was an undergraduate at Marquette, I took courses in national security history with a famous historian of the FBI named Ethan Theoharis. And I wanted to do a 10-page research paper at the end of the course. And in my research, I just started looking through newspapers from the 1930s and 1940s, and I came across the press coverage of the Christian Front trial. And I was absolutely astounded that there were Roman Catholics who were caching weapons and who were building bombs and who were charged with trying to overthrow the government. This was just unfathomable to me because in my theology classes and in my Catholic history classes, I was being told that at that very period, Catholics were making their way in American society and assimilating into the U.S. government. They were actually kind of becoming symmetric with the U.S. government, not trying to overthrow it. So I became interested in this as a kind of a 19 and 20 year old and kept it in the back of my head. And then when I started writing the book on Vatican diplomacy, which you mentioned in the introduction, the group kept popping up in the 1930s and 40s as a matter of concern for the Vatican. But the papers of Pope Pius XII weren't opened yet, so I wasn't able to get into that particular aspect of it, but I kept it in the back of my mind. And then as I went through, I kept seeing here and there issues connected to this group called the Christian Front. So about 10 years ago, I decided to search out the FBI file, which other historians said never existed. They said there is no FBI file. Nobody can find one. And I just kept digging and digging, and I found a case number. I went to the National Archives. The archivists there three times sent me away. They said they didn't have any file on this case. And I came back to them. I said, it was a huge case in the spring of 1940. You have to have a file. And I just kind of ultimately kind of through sheer willpower, I just prevailed upon them and found a case number on the internet of all places in a discussion group on the internet on Reddit. And went back and got the FBI file declassified. It was 2,500 pages long. It was the largest single file of that period until the file on Martin Luther King Jr. and the SCLC was released.
So you said earlier that the group itself had destroyed its file. So I presume that means that the majority of data that you accessed is from the FBI itself?
Yeah. So to be specific, the group itself destroyed its registration cards because it didn't want the authorities to know who the actual members were. But the security agencies, particularly the FBI, had sporadically either infiltrated the group or sent agents to surveil the meetings. And so that's how we know what they were talking about at their meetings. And we know what the informant actually can give us what they were talking about at their, for example, their bomb-making sessions. It was a very chilling account of how to make a pipe bomb. And the reason I included that, because that was kind of a moral decision that I had to make. It was kind of that decision about the anarchist cookbook brought up. You know, do you show this? Well, one of the reasons I put it in is a very, very graphic paragraph giving the Christian Front bomb maker his say on how to actually make a pipe bomb. And morally, I was kind of conflicted by that. But historiographically, for decades, historians had poo-pooed this group as being crackpots who were non-lethal, who really didn't pose any threat to either American society, safety, or the government. And with these verbatims from the FBI file, from the informants themselves, you can actually see that not only did they really mean business, but they were very proficient in creating these weapons of war. And so that's really why I put that in there. And there was a bit of moral consternation about that as well.
So would you say that you said there were 2,500 pages of records in the FBI file? Is that correct?
Yeah. So the 2,500 pages on the FBI file for the group, then there was another 950 pages on the FBI file of the Nazi who recruited the leadership of the group. And then there was another 750 pages of the FBI file for the Boston leadership of the group. And for each tranche of FBI documents that I had to research with, it took 2 years, between 18 months and 2 years to get them released. So it took about 10 years altogether to write the book.
So, would you say that of all those thousands of pages, that the bomb making instructions were the most chilling thing that you discovered there? I mean, I think
for me, because they're the most, well, other than the anti-Semitic exterminationism that comes out in the pages. But for me, it was this question of, you know, the anarchist cookbook, because they're quite graphic, you know, how to build a pipe bomb. And, you know, the thing is, they're all Catholics and they're in their basements in Brooklyn and they're taking courses on this. And that's notwithstanding the military style target practices that they're having, which are also a part of the narrative.
Where were the members of this group hearing the anti-Semitic diatribes? Was this coming from Germany? Was this coming from American figures like Father Coughlin? Like, where was this coming from?
So the anti-Semitism is really tied to Father Charles Coughlin's skewed view of American and global Judaism. By 1938, Coughlin is conflating Judaism and communism, and he's buying into what historians call the Judeo-Bolshevist myth. And that is that—
We're talking about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And he's arguing that because Marx's grandfather was a rabbi and Lenin had Jewish lineage, that the political philosophy of communism, of Leninist communism in particular, was a Jewish construction. And it's really— communism is nothing more than a secular form of Judaism. It's secular Judaism with a social justice component intact, but social justice at the end of a bayonet. And so he sees that the tip of that bayonet is pointed at the heart of the mystical body of Christ. And so he creates this Christian front in North America in order to act as a militaristic, paramilitaristic foil to what he sees as violent communism happening across the globe, both not only in Spain, but in Mexico during the 1920s.
Right. So the group itself sort of reflected— Charles Coughlin was a very interesting and complicated figure because he combined in himself both a very sincere and deep concern for social justice, mm-hmm. and for people on the edge of society, with a quite overt fascism. So the group itself kind of reflected those impulses.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in the book, I go into and I make the argument that Father Charles Coughlin was the first American Catholic of any prominence to tout the language of human rights. As early as 1934, in his 16-point program, the 16th point is about the sanctity of human rights. And to put that in perspective, the historian Samuel Moyne says that in the mid-1930s, hardly anyone was talking about human rights. And Coughlin was very graphic about tying human rights to economic rights and seeing the dignity of the person as tied to their economic well-being. Now, the aggressors against those, particularly Christians, were, in his view, were Jews, and that Jews were causing all the trouble for Christians as they tried to work their way out of the tragedy of the economic depression of 1929. And by 1938, he decides that it's no longer time for words, that he can create a sub rosa paramilitary wing of a public movement, which he calls the Christian Front, in order to bring about real change. And for him, it's in 1939 and 1940, it's the overthrow of the US government, which he saw as peppered with communists within Roosevelt's cabinet. And then later on, that whole philosophy gives permission, moral permission, for the leadership in Boston to move towards taking direction from the Nazi party.
This is very interesting. So would you say that the primary impulse that got the group going and growing was the inspiration of Father Coughlin? Was it anti-Semitism? Was it opposition to Roosevelt himself? Or was it all those things in a kind of a witch's brew?
It's all those things in a witch's brew, but the primary impulse, unfortunately, is the baked-in anti-Semitism, which was a part of pre-Vatican II Roman Catholicism, and in particular, the teaching on the deicide, that the Jews were responsible for the death of Christ, had paid huge dividends to Coughlin as he went around espousing Judeo-Bolshevism and for all the lay leadership. And so it's this kind of baked-in anti-Semitism theologically, which is helping to inspire this asymmetric paramilitarism. And this is what I want, have always wanted to put forward as a theme in the book, is that so many historians who look at Father Coughlin are political historians, and they love writing about kind of the voting blocks and the number of voters and the pure political power that Coughlin was accumulating. My book, I want to show, well, that political power doesn't come out of nowhere. He's using theology. He's using kind of mainstream Catholic beliefs to play into his corner and to push Catholics to make political decisions that are in alignment with his thinking about communism and Judaism.
You are well aware, Charlie, one of the big moments at the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, when they were discussing the document that became the document on the relation of Catholicism to non-Christian religions, but they called for the revision of the Good Friday rites in Catholic churches, because there was a very infamous prayer in that rite called the Prayer for the Perfidious Jews, where Catholics on Good Friday act, well, it was in Latin, so hopefully fewer people understood actually what's going on. But the prayer was that they would be converted and move from their God-killing ways to an acceptance of Christ. So it was quite overt, actually. So I think you're right. It was your phrase of the baked-in anti-Semitism, I think, is an appropriate one. Let's prescind for a moment from, say, the 17 leaders of the Boston Group. Were the tens of thousands of people who subscribed, it's an image that's not going to leave my mind anytime soon, of all these people in their Brooklyn basements making pipe bombs, were they aware that this was a Nazi sort of led or a Nazi-related group? But how aware were the rank and file that this was all tied in some explicit way with the Nazi Party?
Well, the ties to the Nazi Party were camouflaged via the theological constructions that were being put forward by the lay leadership. In a sense, you could say that what was emerging at the time was a priesthood of the laity. And so the leaders of the Christian Front on the ground in both Brooklyn and in Boston were devout Catholic men who had excellent public speaking skills and organizational skills. So they were able to play a dual role. They could get up and give a stump speech to Catholics that was barbed with anti-Semitism, but also couched in the theological constructions of the day. In the book, I go into mystical body of Christ theology and Catholic action, two of these theologies that have really fallen off the radar today that nobody knows about, but which were dominant in the day. And so the leader of the Christian Front in Brooklyn was a devout Catholic named John Cassidy, who could get up on a stage and make a rousing religio-political speech that would keep the people coming to the weekly meetings. In the background, he was recruiting paramilitary cells, because each time a member of the Christian Front filled out an identity card, they had to state if they had prior military experience, and particularly if they had ever been a member of a gun club. And so in New York, Cassidy was able to surveil his membership roles and do talent spotting for who could be a member of the secretive paramilitary wing called the Action Committee. Likewise in Boston, the leadership in Boston, Francis Moran, was a former Franciscan seminarian who was adept at creating a public persona that could take the stage. And FBI reports say that he was a mesmerizing speaker. And he would pack thousands of people into Hibernian Hall in Boston to come hear his public speeches, which were a mix of, if you were to take the newspaper headlines and interject a Catholic religious view on the newspaper headlines of the day, that's what Moran was doing. Hundreds and thousands of people were coming to his weekly and sometimes bi-weekly meetings, but they knew nothing about his secret meetings with the Nazi SS officer. And so it's a kind of a dual track book where you see this public showing of what the Christian Front was actually able to do in society without their membership even knowing of the impulses that were really pushing them forward.
Now, granted that all these people involved were lay people, I find it impossible that no one in the Catholic Archdiocese knew something about this. Was the Archbishop and the people who ran the Diocese of Boston completely in the dark about what was happening?
So I think, again, this is where the historians kind of dropped the ball on this group, is that they were so focused on trying to find an institutional archdiocesan link, you know, because for anything to be Catholic, it had to be officially Catholic. And this group was entirely unofficially Catholic. To answer your original question, in the summer of 1940, just as the Christian Front was about to dissipate and fall apart, a Jesuit at Boston College named Ahern gives a speech on a radio show that he has, which, because he was interested in the New York case having concluded, that he gave an hour-long speech on a radio show in Boston saying that it was morally permissible now for New England Catholics to join the Christian Front in Boston in particular, because inasmuch as the Christian Front was anti-Semitic, they were entirely anti-communistic and consequently were doing Catholic action. Well, this radio show gives an entire boost to the membership of the Christian Front. And kind of Moran, who's the leader in Boston, goes on a recruitment tour and thousands of new members pop up. At the same time, Moran makes an overture to Cardinal O'Connell in Boston, who, in fact, although many people see him as pro-Mussolini and having fascist sympathies, there was one thing he was, and that was he was very anti-Coughlin. And so when Moran makes his approach to Cardinal O'Connell to get official sanction for his lay group, O'Connell dismisses him and never even acknowledges that he had received the letter seeking approval. This is where I see the point where Moran, and if you look at the timeline, it's once he is rebuffed by O'Connell that he falls into the arms of Herbert Scholz, who's the Nazi SS officer. So it's you know, it's a lay movement. It's hundreds and thousands strong. They think it's authentically Catholic. And this is the kind of the mystery about it, because they were authentically Catholic, right? They were believing in mystical body of Christ theology and Catholic action, but the anti-Semitism was so baked into the official theology of the church that they were calling themselves, and they could call themselves Catholic without having that episcopal imprimatur. And so it's a part of I think about why they were overlooked, but also it's a part about why they were, the same reason is why they were so successful.
How concrete were the plans of Catholic Action, or the Action Committee, let's say? How concrete were the plans to spark a revolution of the Action? Or are we talking about buildings targeted and people targeted and things like that?
For about 80 years, most historians characterize the plot as a playful plot perpetrated by crackpots. And in the book, I go into what I call the false flag defensive counterattack doctrine, which was put forward by John Cassidy. And it was to begin with a bombing campaign. And we have the bomb. We have photos of the bombs they were making. So it's to begin with a bombing campaign, which is the false flag bombing campaign. It was a bombing campaign that was to be placed in around New York City, banks, the Federal Reserve, bridges, utilities. And those bombs were to be blamed on the Communist Party USA functionaries. There was a paramilitary wing of the Communist Party USA. So the Christian Fronters were going to blame this bombing campaign on the CPUSA. And then they were going to come forward. They believed that Governor Lehman would call out the National Guard. And the Christian Front had done a huge recruitment effort to infiltrate the New York National Guard, which was successful. You know, and we had these questions after January 6th. There were all equal questions about infiltration of the National Guard on January 6th. Well, read about it in 1940 if you're interested. Then Christian Front members of the National Guard would come forward and alongside the National Guard putting down that communist insurrection plot, they would then mark themselves as the Christian saviors of the Republic and helping to put down the communist insurrection, which was being played out in New York. And so what you have here is this kind of crazy plot, which was some of the members, when the FBI interviewed them afterwards, said it was absolutely wide-eyed crazy. But for the action committee, they believed in what they were doing. And you can read the verbatims about how they felt about their mission in pulling this off. And the reason why the FBI actually moved in ahead of time was that they were worried that if all the bombs were detonated, they would lose the evidence to procure a conviction in court, which seems reasonable.
So what happened in the Capitol building on January 6, 2021 must have been a chilling deja vu for you?
Well, the Christian Front plot, these cats were armed to the teeth. That's the other kind of extraordinary thing, is that for so many decades, historians have missed that they were paramilitarized and loaded for bear, as it were. And for some reason, they kept being dismissed as kind of playful, insignificant crackpots who would never amount to anything. They had stolen, for example, this is new, what historians didn't know about. They had actually stolen two Browning Light machine guns from an armory in Boston. Now, a Browning Light machine gun, in the day, it was a super weapon. In fact, a Browning Light machine gun shoots 300 rounds a minute of a .30-06 shell, which is a 3-inch full metal jacket shell. It's so powerful that air forces up until the 1980s were mounting those machine guns on the wings of their air force planes. Two of those had been stolen from an armory in Boston and had been completely unaccounted for and were never reported to the FBI by the local FBI office due to corruption in the FBI, and was never reported to the Massachusetts National Guard headquarters due to corruption. So there was a kind of a co-equal kind of corrupt plan to keep silent that those weapons had been stolen, because neither the FBI officers involved nor the National Guard officers involved in Massachusetts wanted to lose their jobs. So we only know about this kind of 80 years later. And the real worry about not publicizing or not mentioning to their superiors that these guns were stolen was that they were convinced, both the FBI and the National Guard locally were convinced, that the Boston Police Department would go on strike because there was no counterweapon, and that they would be mowed down if they tried to take any measures against the Christian Front. Okay. Fascinating stuff. So there's this paramilitary side, and there's this kind of paramilitarism driven by these religious, kind of authentic religious Catholic doctrines.
So in the book, you say that in January of 1940, the FBI broke into the homes and basements of all these people. If the FBI had not made those raids in January of 1940, how close was the action committee to actually doing something? Did the FBI break in just in time, or was the plot to do something further along than January of 1940?
So the plot was to have another round of paramilitary training, which included target practice and bomb detonations. Now, it was the first time that they were thinking about detonating bombs. They were actually going out. They had secret locations where they did target practice with their military grade weaponry. They were using guns that were procured for the military through the Department of War. They actually were able to get their weapons through the Department of War, the Office of Civilian Marksmanship in the Department of War. You could legally purchase military grade rifles, in this case, Springfield 1903 rifles, 60 rounds a minute, breech loading rifle, destructive weapon of war, and have it shipped to your doorstep for about $9. And legally, you could have it shipped to your doorstep if you were a member of the NRA. And so that's how they cashed their weapons and got their explosive material for making of bombs through their membership in the National Rifle Association. So they were scheduling another round of target practice and bomb detonation for January 20th of 1940. And that's why on January 14th, on the evening of January 13th, actually, the FBI decided to get warrants. You know, they got warrants and then they did the arrests, but it's unclear to me about the precise timing. But if you read the book, you can see that there is an increasing arc of urgency for the plan to go into effect. They were not fooling around. And Cassidy was the primary motivator of this.
So at what point, how long before January 1940, is your sense that the FBI knew about all of this and had infiltrated the group?
As early as the spring of 1939, they're kind of aware of the group. By the summer and fall of 1939, they have infiltrated it. And they infiltrated it because an ordinary citizen named Dennis Healy, who was a member of the New York National Guard, was approached by a Christian Front member. And Healy was a machine gunner. And this Christian Front member came to him just out of the blue and said, "I've got a group of friends and we want you to teach us how to use a Browning light machine gun." And Healy was just kind of knocked off his heels. And he said that he would think about it. And then Healy went right to the FBI field office and said, "Listen, this member of a group called the Christian Front has just asked me to be a trainer for his group to use these kind of super weapons of war, at least on the battlefield." So
did he become a spy for the FBI? Did he become an informant himself?
He did become an informant for the FBI. And then his status as an informant becomes more and more precarious as he goes on, because he starts demanding money. And then he invites Christian Front members over to his house, and the basement of his house is all lined with FBI microphones. He plies them with alcohol and asks them to start talking about their revolutionary plot. So all these kind of entrapment things. And so it's kind of like what's going on today with the whole kind of vilification theory about this Ray Epps character. And I mean, I was thinking about Ray Epps and the Fedsurrection charge. I mean, oh my gosh, is Ray Epps the Dennis Healy of the 1940 amazing Christian Front plot?
Now, you mentioned first off that they were acquitted in the trial. How is it that they were not guilty? How could that be?
Yeah, so there are three elements to this. The technical legal charges were, first of all, sedition, which in my view was the kind of more publicly charged and primarily a publicity charge. So to get national headlines and to get the attention. And so they charged these men in Brooklyn who were merely talking about revolution, and there were no anti-terrorism statutes on the books then. Even the Smith Act doesn't come in until later in that year after the case is over. So the sedition charge is hard to prove. The government has to prove that these cats in Brooklyn want to overthrow the US government in Washington and the Capitol. So that's harder to prove. Where the government really, really thought they had the conviction wrapped up was in the weapons theft charge from a U.S. arsenal. They were convinced that the Christian Front had stolen the rifles. And of course, they didn't know about the Brownings that actually had been stolen. But the rifles that they were cashing were military weapons, but they were all bought legally through the National Rifle Association. And in fact, the FBI had no idea that ordinary citizens could buy weapons of war through their membership in the National Rifle Association. This was news up and down the FBI. FBI director didn't know about it. The attorney general had no idea, but it was this crazy rule that had been written into the Army Code in 1903 after the Spanish-American War, because the Army was convinced after the Spanish-American War that ordinary citizens couldn't shoot straight. So if you're going to have a volunteer army, you need to be able to have civilians get trained in marksmanship. So the NRA gladly stepped up and could provide you with a military rifle in order to do that. That's how the Christian Front got their weapons. Now, there is some research that's being done. There's a graduate student at George Washington University. He's doing research on whether Nazi intelligence was behind getting the awareness of that Army Code regulation to be known by pro-fascist elements in the United States. And there is some evidence that German intelligence was trying to make this known to pro-Nazi elements in the US that they could cash weapons this way.
Interesting. So I know about this because I'm reading the New York Times about the January 6th, 2021 mm-hmm. thing. The case for sedition is a very difficult one to prove, because you have Absolutely. To prove that there's a corporate plot. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But as you just said, the fact that they had received these rifles legitimately, legally through the NRA. Did that collapse the case? Was that the thing that...
Yeah, that absolutely collapsed the case. Now, in connection to January 6th, what I see as more appropriate for today's sedition discussion is that the Justice Department did not charge the Oath Keepers, I guess in this case, with sedition. They charged them with seditious conspiracy, which I think they're going to have a much harder time overcoming. Yeah, I think that many in the press are looking at whether or not the rioters at the Capitol were armed insurrectionists, and that and many of them, I guess most of them weren't. I guess they do not have a kind of armament on site at the Capitol. I could be wrong on that, but I'm not following it that closely. But I think it was real. I think it's really interesting that the DOJ charged the recent insurrectionists with seditious conspiracy, which I think is a much easier charge to prove, particularly if they have informants inside, as Healey was, and will probably be successful. I predict that the DOJ will be successful and probably get a conviction on that count.
Charlie, this has been an incredibly interesting and exciting discussion. So thank you for your interesting book. Speaking personally, I'm going to run out and buy it. And I hope your listeners, our listeners, will do the same. Good luck on your next project. I hope your next project is as interesting as the last two you've done. And
thank you.
I know we caught you on a hard day when you were teaching. So thank you for speaking with us. And we wish you Godspeed in your research.
Thank you very much, Mark. I really appreciate being with you and your audience today.
Thank you for listening to Religion and American Life, a podcast by the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. For more information on the work of the Boisy Center, the center's schedule of events, or to listen to other episodes of this podcast, please visit our website at bc.edu/Boisy.